Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we're sitting down with the host and producer of the Emmy-nominated game design podcast, Dice Exploder, Sam Dunnewald, to discuss what he's learned from 3 years of interviews and how he's using those lessons to launch his first physical release, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Sam, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Woo!
It's good to be here.
Woo.
I've had you guys on my show before. It's always fun talking with you. Always fun podcasting with you. I'm glad we get to do it in a context where I don't have to edit it this time.
Because yeah, we're so too. Verbose.
Yeah.
Sam, we're so excited to have you. You know, we're obviously huge fans of Dice Exploder. You're part of the network. You know, we love talking to you about games and actual play. But we're here to talk about specifically your first physical game release, Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, and how 3 years of doing Dice Exploder, a podcast where you've spent hours and hours and hours dissecting individual game mechanics, has led to you now making a game and releasing a game. So the first question that I want to kind of ask you to set the table is, how has these 3 years of Dice Exploder helped you develop a personal game design ethos?
Yeah. I mean, I think when you sit down and you talk about anything for 3 years, you just develop a lot of opinions about it, right? I think Dice Exploder is a show that has affected those opinions a lot, but honestly, not as much as just playing those games and playtesting. Like about three and a half years ago, around the same time that I started Dice Exploder, around the same time that I started designing Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, I started going to a every other week Monday night game meetup at the local gaming store Geeky Tees here in Burbank, California. And that meetup, I think, has been more influential on my understanding of game design than Dice Exploder has, just because you like play a shitload of games. I think so. Dice Exploder has obviously like influenced a lot of stuff. And I think if you go back and listen to the very first trailer of Dice Exploder, one of the things that I'm talking about is like, there's a lot of conversations out there about high level theory, but that's not where I learn about game design best. Like, that's fun. Sure. If you want to do your taxonomies, like, cool. I've certainly done my taxonomies, you know, but like when I'm like feeling like I'm making level up moments, it's about taking a really specific example from a game and breaking that example down with someone who disagrees with me typically. And like, what can we learn from talking about that? What can we learn from talking with each other? And that's what Dice Exploder is, right? It's like, let's take the most small specific example we can and really break that thing down. And I think that I've learned through having those conversations, like a number of things, right? Like I really love, you could hear it in the premise of that already. I love small. I love defined. I love like really getting really specific. And Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is like a one-shot game. You could make it a campaign. It's got like a legacy kind of option to it. But like much like almost every game I've ever made, it's one shot because I want to go small. And I think after that, I've learned like a lot of stuff that you hear people talk about just like learning in their artistic practices all the time, right? Like intentionality, super important, right? Like you want every single piece of your thing to be in support of whatever the whole is. And I think you really see that in the way I've been able to take really small mechanics from games and blow up. Here, you can see in this one little interaction all the themes that exist in the whole game, you know, in all these other places within the game. And like, I remember very fondly, one of my favorite episodes is with Alex Roberts talking about Kagamatsu, which is this game about a samurai coming to a village and like the women of the village trying to get him to help them with some sort of problem by using their romantic feminine wiles, whether genuinely or otherwise. And like, we took like one tiny mechanic from that game and ended up at this like, what is love conversation that I found to be like the best what is love conversation I'd ever had in my life. You know, like I think that that specificity blows up into like specificity becomes universal. Like that's a classic, another like artistic, like go make the thing only you can make kind of thing. And I've learned that from Dice Exploder. But I think like going back to the one shots meetup kind of thing, like a big lesson that I've learned also is games evolve with their designer to fit that designer's play culture, and that the play culture around that designer is really influential on what the game ends up being too, because it's influencing the designer. And to that end, like, I think because I was spending so much time at this one shots meetup, like, that's another reason I made a one shot game, like, right? Like, that's another reason this game takes 2 hours to play as opposed to 4 hours to play, like, because that's how much time we have before the store closes, and so on and so forth. Like, I think all that has come, it's like stuff that influenced me coming out of the meetup, and that I like reinforced by seeing it happen to other designers when I talked about them on Dice Exploder.
That bit just reminded me, I was reading through the rule book for Flail, which is like a new game by Andre Novoa from Games Omnivorous. I think at the time of release, this it might be crowdfunding as well, so go check it out. But in the intro, there's a section where Andre says something along the lines of like, there are a lot of games in the OSR that I really like that have like bits and pieces. This is my attempt to make the exact game I wanted. And it seems like the more we've talked to designers, it is a lot of that. It's like, I've found so many things that are so close to what I want, and exactly what I want isn't out there, so I simply have to make it for myself.
Yeah. Well, the OSR especially is just riddled with that, right? Because especially people making OSR dungeon crawlers, like, listen, there's a lot of different good ones, and they do play differently, but like, when was the last time there was like actual huge innovation there? Like His Majesty the Worm maybe is doing interesting stuff. Like Shadow Dark is a great execution, but like, I don't know. Those are all kind of the same game that is just like, let me show you my homebrew rules. And I think that's great, right? Like everyone has their different set of homebrew rules, and some of those are like play better than others, like across the board. And really when it comes down to it, like I don't care about the homebrew rules so much as I care about what are your vibes coming into this, right? Are you making like a Troika Gonzo kind of thing? Are you making like a really grimdark thing? Are you doing the like over the top Merkborg thing? All those things, like all those games have basically the same rules, but like the vibes are still really different. I'm still getting something really different from the game, and that's really exciting to me too.
So, I mean, there's a few things you laid out there in this like how your own ethos has developed. Words we love on this show: intentionality, specificity, one shot games, capsule games, like focused on like 1 to 2 hour experiences. These are all things that we love. With Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, can you tell us what Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is and how it encapsulates a lot of these things you just identified?
Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is it's my John Wick simulator. It's like a one shot. It's a deck builder RPG that uses a standard deck of playing cards. I really have always loved playing cards. I love Magic the Gathering. I played a shitload of Slay the Spire, and I really wanted... I looked around at a certain point and was like, why isn't there a deck builder RPG? I need a deck builder RPG. I'm so, I must like role play with cards. And so that's mechanically where this came from. I think really the mechanical origin point is the origin point. And at some point that was kicking around my head and then clicked into John Wick, and that I got there off of that. But yeah, I mean, I feel like in games, doing approximately a movie tends to be a session. You know, we think about like in a campaign game, a session often like correlates to a chapter of a book or an episode of television. But once we're in to single session games, like it feels a lot like a movie. And if you're basing something on like how a movie works, probably you're getting to a single session kind of experience. The clearer the end point, also I think the more you tend to get towards a one session experience. And John Wick, like the setup is so clear. Like, is he going to kill the guy who killed his dog? And what's it going to cost him to try? And like, that's it. We can answer those questions really quickly. And I guess you could really slow burn it, but also you could like really slow burn a game of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, I guess, if you wanted to. And so I think the story, the kind of story that the game is trying to tell, sort of dictated the experience of how long it was going to be. That's something that also just sort of like generally like a design lesson I feel like I've learned is it's really helpful to, really necessary to not just kind of have an opinion about what the game wants to be, but to like listen to the game as you're designing it and like listen to what it wants to be. Like sometimes as you're playing, you can just feel this game wants to wrap up now. You know, when I sat down to like play Bandits and Bullet Holes, the mechanical things that were important to me were like the particular mechanic for how the cards were going to work in people, in characters' decks, which basically hasn't changed the whole time. Basically what you got is playing cards and you give each playing card a corresponding like character trait. And so they're called, collectively, they're calling cards, right? You take a playing card and you Sharpie right on their punchable face. And now Barf has, my go-to example character from this game, he's got a punchable face and he's got the stench of cigars. And now we know a lot about Barf, right? And like now when we like play, when he goes head to head with someone else, he's like, we're just going to play war together with our decks of cards because who cares? And when I flip up my punchable face against your nail gun, well, you know, we get to talk through how that goes, right? So just taking that core mechanic and sitting down for the first playtest and being like, let's see what happens now, the game just wrapped up in a session, right? And I think if the game had not wrapped up in a session, I would have kept going and made something that felt more like a short campaign or even a long campaign kind of thing. But that people, I do think that the one-shotness very much comes from, this goes back to what I was saying about the OSR thing, how much the genre that a game is influences the play experience of it, right? When you sit down at the table and you tell people we're doing a John Wick thing now, they like get it. Even if they haven't seen John Wick, they know roughly what the idea is there, right? And they like click in to what the tone is going to be. And with that also comes like expectations around what are the scenes going to look like? What are the character interactions going to look like? Like, what are all these other pieces? How long is it going to go, right? We all just kind of feel out the rhythm of a revenge story like that because we have it internally just through osmosis, like living in our brains. And so I think that really set the baseline for what the edges, what the bounds of this game were going to be.
You said two things in there that I really want to call out because I think you clarified something that has been kind of like vaguely in my mind that I think is really important to call out. Of the clarity of the ending allows you to do something in a one shot, which I think is really true. When I'm looking at my shelf of like the time we have Star-Crossed, Last Train to Bremen, all of those have a very clearly defined ending that you're working
ten
towards.
Candles.
You can 10 candles and you can easily get there in a session. Like I've never been worried about any of those games going longer than I expect them to. And then the clarity of vibe and genre means you can get started so much quicker than other games because everyone has that same footing. So the second you have both of those things, now you have a game that starts quick and ends on time, which is really a really clear synthesis of things that I think anyone designing one-shot games should be really aware of.
I mean, I think people designing campaign games should be really aware of this too. This is you've activated my trap card here of what I'm excited about in game design right now. I put out this blog post a couple of months ago called Apollo 47 Core Design. I think this is the wrong name for it, but I'm gonna go through the example. Apollo 47 is this game by Tim Hutchings where you were playing like astronauts for NASA after everything has become boring. We're on Apollo 47 now, right? And the rules for the game, basically what you're doing in the game is you're just like going on a spacewalk and radioing back and forth for each other. And as soon as something exciting happens, you have to stop playing. And that's like it. Those are basically the whole rules. The rules are like one page long, but the game is published as like a 600 page volume. That's like one page of rules, 599 pages of NASA technical manuals, like actual NASA technical manuals. It's a very good joke. It's good stuff. But like the more I've been playing games recently, the more I've been realizing that the stuff I'm really excited about kind of takes that same form factor. The way I've been evolving this, because I don't actually think Apollo 47 is a good example of this in the end, but I've been calling this 55 swords design in the sense of like 55 swords, 55 knights, 55 myths, 55, like, you know, like the I think you can should leave meme. But so Mythic Bastion Land is, I think, the best example of this right now.
That was just where my brain was going.
Yeah, you have these tight rules, and the rules are really important. The rules are really good. Yeah, you're holding it up, Brian. It looks beautiful. I've got it right back here. I've played a few sessions of this game. I can't wait to play more of this game. It's a fabulous game. But the magic of it is it's got these tight rules. Every rule is really important, but there's not that many of them. There's 18, 20 pages of rules. Some of those were already like getting into random tables, which are rules, but like they're not like procedures in the same way. And the way that game works is each of its rules, this is kind of a crude metaphor, but I feel like is like a gun. And then the back of the book is just ammunition, right? Like that it like it comes with a bunch of procedures for how to take all this ammunition, hook in mechanically to that ammunition, and then fire at it at you at the table, right? So that you and the GM is the one kind of like operating that whole Rube Goldberg machine. Like a lot of that, I think, becomes invisible to the players. But when this is set up well, the GM also isn't having to do a lot of work because the rules are so tight. They're like taking care of a lot of that stuff, right? Like the designer has really done the work, has done the legwork to bring this back into some like discourse from the OSR for the past couple of years of like, there's been all this discourse there about like games are better when you do the legwork, when you do the prep, when like you can feel the world around you. Like, you know, world building games are a different kind of thing, but like it's fun to show up at the table and be like, we understand the bounds of this world. We know that what's going on in the next town, whether or not we go over there, right? Like it's cool to have that stuff already defined. And I think I really love games where the designer has done the legwork rather than the where the designer is asking me, the GM, to prep that legwork because I'm busy. Yep. I have movies to write. Like I've got games to design and a podcast to record. I just want to show up and use your beautiful rules at the start of Mythic Bastion Land to set all that crap up for me. And I think that that's beautiful. I think that that's really exciting stuff. Like other games I feel like have done this really well. I'm playing Under Hollow Hills right now from The Bakers, which is their like PBTA opus. I don't think enough people understand that it's like an evolution of Apocalypse World. It's fabulous. It's wonderful stuff. People should be playing this game. Yeah, look at it. It looks nice. But like it has the same thing, like over half that, maybe not over half that book, a quarter of that book at the back is not, it's not even like pre-written characters in the same way that Mythic Bastion Land has them, but it is like, here are some really detailed procedures for how you create characters, create events, create occasions for your fairy circus to perform at, all these different things that you need to play the game. And I think that those almost GM facing tools for prep, for generating what is the thing going to be that we're going to do. In a one shot, probably many one shot games, you don't need all that kind of crap because we're just going to sit down and we're going to do the best one of those things, right? Like Last Train to Bremen, you don't need a bunch of generators for who are the potential members of this band. We just know the potential members of this band. We don't need to know what was which evil creature did you make a deal with? You just made a deal with the devil, right? And so the scope of one-shot games by being more contained, I think, like, helps kick you off. But, like, especially once you're making bigger games, I think having all this stuff is really useful and effective and, like, under-created out there right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love that you brought up Mythic Bastion. Brian, will it be announced, actually, quick check, by the time we release this in May?
Probably not. I mean, we could.
We could, I suppose. We're playing Mythic Bastion Land on our next season. Sick. I'm gonna drop it here. Eagle-eared fans will get maybe that little preview if we haven't announced it. But I love the ammunition and gun metaphor. I think that is so. It's getting to a thing in my head where it's like, if Mythic Bastion Land is gun and ammunition, then a one shot game like Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is like a single shot gun that like you throw to the side, like it's,
or
it's like it comes
a sword,
preloaded. It's like,
right, like it's already sword, yeah. Like if we're keeping the weapon
it's
metaphor
ready.
yeah like yeah. The thing I've been thinking about is in my first execution of this metaphor, we're really going to torture this metaphor. It's a gun where it doesn't have bullets, it just has one of those flags that says bang come out of it, where yeah. Like it only has one thing that it can do, right? Like it is a single object. This is the thing that's interesting about Mythic Bastion Land, right? Is you have set of procedures that are like waiting for ammunition. And Last Train to Bremen, all the ammunition and the procedure are one. There is no separation between the two.
I'm also like, there's a thread that is maybe I'm taking us a little bit adjacent, but like the idea of length and knowing the length of what you're doing and like, and movie length and these kind of setting expectations on people's shared understanding of genre. I want to diverge a little bit our path and talk about actual play, because I know you're a person who has a lot of opinions about actual play as well. And I think it's like, it's an interesting thing where when we're thinking about actual play, we always, I can't remember the last time we did a 3-hour session. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we now are like, we gotta keep it to 2 hours. We gotta cut it down to 1 hour 45. Like, say for maybe like a finale where we gotta do like a 30-minute epilogue after or something. But like, it's the power of length of time is such an interesting thing for me in game design and in actual play. And like, I'm curious, I think what I want to get at with this question, I'm finding it as I'm saying it, is that do you see Band-Aids and Bullet Holes as an actual playable game? Like, do you think that it fits well in actual play as a game?
Yes, yes. And it also, this is such a good question, because I think the way Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is good at actual play is going to come directly out of all those opinions that I was talking about of like what kind of games I like to design and my opinions about actual play. Because I'm going to explain a little bit about how Band-Aids and Bullet Holes should work, or how it works, and then how I think actual plays of the game will best function and why that's the kind of actual play that I love. So the way Band-Aids and Bullet Holes works, once you actually get to the table, is you do some setup. You know, you're doing classic, like, so let's take the 55 swords like theory of design here. The game comes with like 12 pre-generated characters and 4 powder kegs, which are basically like scenarios, like stories, frameworks, right? So we have like Dead Mentor, in which there are 2 students of a mentor. The mentor's been murdered. One of the students believes the other student killed the mentor. Revenge ensues, right? And now there's like 6 characters sort of in that story framework that have a vested interest in what's going on. And the first thing you do is you take the like 12 pre-generated characters and you like cast the powder keg, right? You're like, who's the dead mentor? Well, maybe that's Barf. Who's the student? Well, maybe we wanted that person to be Barf. We'll negotiate it. But you fill in the you fill in the powder keg with a bunch of ammunition, aka the characters. And as you're doing that, you're defining the characters a little bit more, but, you know, we go around, we get all that set up, and then we start going around and taking turns. This game actually started as, like, a Firebrand's hack, like a The King is Dead hack, where on your game, on your turn, you would pick from a list of scenes and then do that thing. And I realized there was only one scene. And so it still works that way. There's just only one choice to make. And that scene is you want something. You as the player decide which character you're going to pick up. There's not character fidelity in this game. You can play any of the characters. So I can play Barf in the first scene, and then Brian can play Barf in the second scene, and then Elliot can pick up some other character entirely in the third scene, and we go from there. So I want to be Barf, and what I want is I want Queenie to tell me who killed my dog, right? So who are you, what do you want, and who do you want it from? Those are the opening questions. And then we just like fiasco style role play out the scene. And there's a little bit of like rules in there or whatever, but the important thing is we go around, we take turns framing scenes, we like frame these scenes very strongly, and we don't have this character fidelity going on. So from very early on in the process of playing this game and designing this game, I was like, I want to do an actual play of this game where every episode is one scene and we have 10 minute long episodes and we keep character fidelity so we can have like a wider cast too, right? Like you can just say, hey, Brian is Barf every time. And now if this scene happens to involve Barf, great, Brian's in the episode, you know? And there tend to be a lot of supporting cast characters who will show up like one time. And if you're showing up one time for 10 minutes, it's really easy to like call up your friend who's really busy and be like, you want to come in and do 30 minutes of actual play? Like, I feel like that like logistically there's a lot of like ability to bring in cool people to do that too. And then ideally at the end, so you're either going to have like a single session of actual play at the end, you know, your 1:45 kind of thing, your feature film kind of thing. Or what I feel about actual play is like, I want the episodes tiny, you know, like I really want that like bite size kind of thing. I mean, we've seen this for years with the like binge model of television, right? Where when you sit down at the end of the day and you're deciding what to watch, you put on a movie. No, that's so long. But I will put on 3 episodes of Deep Space Nine, which is longer than most movies, right? Like, because there's like out points in there, right? Like I can check in and be like, do I still want to be watching this? And I remember I used to work for The Onion, and while we were there, I was an editor, a video and a podcast editor, and we did this Serial parody podcast because Serial was the big like hit podcast at the time. And it was like 7-8 episodes long, and each one was like 7 minutes. And I remember going into it being like, what are we doing? No one's going to listen to a 7-minute podcast episode. Like, what are we doing here? And then it was wildly successful because actually everyone just like listens to one. It was so easy to drop in for 7 minutes and be like, do I like this thing? And I feel like actual play needs to solve that problem. Like, you know, I did this whole series on Dice Exploder last fall. Y'all were on it. And one of the things that I talked about in that series is how I think it's really hard to get into any given actual play because there's so many things you need to introduce up top, right? You need to introduce the world of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Who are the characters within that world? But also, who's Elliot? Who's Brian? Who's Sam? Who are the players? What's the like real life layer of the actual play also? And some people are there for the real life layer. And some people are there for the fiction layer. And like, maybe we're keeping the real life layer like metatextual out on Blue Sky or Patreon or whatever. And like all that kind of crap. It's just hard to do all that kind of stuff. And people take their time doing it on actual plays, in my experience. Like, it is hard to hit the ground running. Even, like, I think y'all do a pretty good job on this on My First Dungeon. And it is still, there's just so much to get to. And, like, group improv is such a, by default, like, lethargic form. It's, like, fun to just, like, kick ideas around. You know, when we're off mic, like, so much of sitting down and starting playing is, like, how's your day? Doing this? Like, what's going on here? So I think I want to start with I just did this yesterday. I was like, I think I want to do the like start with an opening flashback thing this session, but like, I'm not quite sure what the flashback is. Can we like talk for 20 minutes about what we think that first scene opening flashback should be? And like that, who wants to listen to that actual play? Like, well, I just want to get to the scene, you know? So like, I think that the framework of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, I haven't been able to put this to the test because making actual plays is very hard, as you very well know. But I think that framework that I'm talking about for here and the kind of actual play that this could be could help solve some of those problems, or at least provide an example of how one might approach solving some of those problems.
It's interesting. There's a couple threads in there that I love, like the idea of this choice, right, where you sit down and you're like, I'm either going to watch a movie. No, that's too long. I'm going to watch 3 episodes of Deep Space Nine. I feel like, and this is going to be a little bit of a harsh take, but like, I feel like for most actual play, that decision feels like, I'm going to sit down and watch 3 movies in a row or watch a TV show.
Yeah,
like it's
100%,
like it's not a binge TV show. It's like, oh my God, I have this movie series has 5 movies and I need to watch them all to experience the story.
They put out a new movie every week, sometimes twice a week. Like, yeah, it's hard to get into.
One of my all-time favorite jokes was from an episode of Bob's Burgers, and it was Luis Belcher describing someone she thought was really boring and lame. And she said, if she were a spice, she'd be flour. If she were a book, she'd be 2 books. I thought that is the cruelest thing to ever say about anyone. But it does kind of get to the point of like actual play of as you're saying, it's a movie every week. And that's just so hard to get into. I feel like we've been doing that here at like My First Dungeon. Like, I keep wanting to get episodes just shorter and shorter and shorter. It's like there's only so much shortness you can do until you change the format entirely. Before it's just, now I'm just cutting this single episode into 2 episodes, which is like, is it shorter? Yes, but also you haven't completed an arc in that time. You've just chopped the arc in half.
I mean, this is maybe why I like the idea of a scene format for like one episode equals one scene, because scenes do have an arc. A good scene does have an arc. In Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, at least, every scene has an arc because I come in wanting something from you and you don't want to give it to me because I've designed the game so that it is almost always true that you don't want to give the thing to me, or you do want to, but you're going to be in trouble if you do. And then we sort that out. And like, that's an arc. Like, if I come out of that getting everything I want, then like, you're in trouble. And the reverse is also true. And so I think that like recognizing where the smaller arcs are and building a game that supports discrete units of those smaller arcs and like, where are the breaking points there? Like, that's because in, you know, Dungeons and Dragons or whatever, the same thing is true of like good players, you know, like if you're listening to Worlds Beyond Number, like they're doing scenes in that too, right? But Dungeons and Dragons is not giving them the tools to do that. Years of improv experience is giving them the tools to do that, right? And a game system that helps define this is the end of a unit of play, I think is likely helpful for demarking where you can break up an actual play episode.
Yeah, there's a similar world that I want to pull on here, and like you referencing the serial thing is interesting because it's like, I'm a big audio drama guy. I've listened to audio dramas for like a decade, and I think it's like some of the most interesting form of podcast and what people are doing with it. And like, the thing that audio dramas got right often is bite size. Like, it's like an effective consumable format of like the Bright Sessions, I think, were.
That's
often
exactly
like
the one
10,
I was just
15
thinking
minutes.
Of. Yeah.
Yeah. And like Magnus Archives is like the, at least in the beginning, it's gotten a little longer after its 200 episode run, like, and then spinoff show. But like the Magnus Archives first few episodes were 15 to 20 minutes. And it's like, I love this idea of doing that with actual play. And I think, you know, the experiment we're trying to do is the Project Echo show. Of course, it has another layer of being a nonlinear release, but
such
each of those
cool
episodes
idea.
Is between three. Oh, thank you. Each episode is between like 3 and 11 minutes, I think, is maybe the longest one we've put out so far.
I think we've had a 15. I just added like a 15 minute one.
But people would tell I would engage in this debate. People might say, well, the Project Echo series is an actual play. You've hidden all the game and you're just including the improvised scene based on the game. And I'm like,
maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah,
maybe.
There's something you said in there that I really wanted to touch on also, which is Magnus Archives, Bright Sessions, episodes get longer as they go on. And I think it's super reasonable for actual plays to do that too. Like, once I'm really excited about your thing. Like, once I'm in, once I know the rules, once I know who the people are, once I'm like on board and I love your thing, when you're putting out an hour 45 minute episode, I'm like, fuck yeah. I get a whole new movie of this every week. Like, that's incredible. But like, it's the getting me in the door, you know, like it's the starting things off. That's where I feel like the shorter form factor is helpful.
Wow. I've never thought about that. You could just change episode times. That you could do half hour episodes for like the introductory like arc and then move to hour and then that's sometimes the things that like really unlock something are so dumb when you say them out. It's like dumb that I didn't think, oh, you could do a half hour show and then make it an hour show later.
Yeah. What, like, why has no one ever thought to do, but also like no one does that. Like there's this like collective understanding that often happens to a medium, I think, that is, develops for a good reason often, but then lingers for not a good reason. Like, I'm thinking about when television was half hour comedy, 1 hour drama, and then like streaming came along and everything became 45 minute dramedy. And like that was in part, you know, now we're dealing with like the aftermath of that. And like, well, now your thing, why isn't your thing a 45 minute dramedy? But like, you know, we had episodes of shows coming out in the early days of Netflix that were just like wildly different runtimes within the same season. And people were like, you can do that? And yeah, well, the medium has changed, you know? And that's, I feel like that is sort of true of actual play. Like, actual play, it makes sense why episodes are the length that they are, because that's how long sessions tend to be, because for a lot of very good reasons, that's how long sessions are when you're at home playing these games. And actual play is like starting from that position and then playing a lot of games that are still designed to do the at-home kind of experience. But yeah, I mean, if I was designing a game specifically for actual play, it'd be 20-minute episodes, right? Like, and there's no reason you can't hack a game to figure that out, or use editing to figure that out, or do the thing.
It's a continued feeling of like this, like I always want people to learn lessons from other art forms in actual play. And it's like, it's a conversation we've had with like Jay Stroutman and others that like, sometimes there's reticence to do so, or like a feeling that actual play is too wholly unique to learn lessons from these other things. But that's a belief I do not subscribe to. I think that, like, you know, we can learn so much from
imagine one artistic medium not being able to learn from another artistic medium. And you can go too far. Let's be clear. Like, I'm sympathetic to people making a certain kind of argument here, but also, like, come on.
Yeah. Well, and so I want to, I'm going to shoehorn in here one of my favorite things you've made is After Image, because I think that After Image is actual play that learned from long form nonfiction narrative podcasting.
Yes.
Like I think that that's like, it's just the most beautiful merging of those. And I think I maybe told you this beforehand, but I taught a podcast class last semester. And this was one of the required listening shows that I made them listen to, because I was like, this is an interesting, this is such an interesting use of the form and an evolution of two different art forms within podcasts that have kind of come together. So I really just want to hear you talk about After Image and like how that came together and why you made that. And is it actual play?
Huge compliment for anything I've ever made to be taught in a class. Like, that was a bucket list item for me. I really appreciate it, Elliot. Do you want to explain to the good people at home what After Image is, or do you want me to do that?
Oh, are you interested in how I explain it? Is that why you ask?
That's why I'm asking. And okay, because I'm a consummate podcast host and can't help turning off the interviewer, but yeah.
After Image is a series on Dice Exploder where you listen to Sam's literal non-fictional experience playing a game, and simultaneously you get blends of the character experience of the game in what I would call a mashup of like This American Life and kind of almost a Magnus Archives, like a first person audio drama. Like, there's a little bit of first person audio drama in there, and then it has also a really beautiful musical connection throughout it that I could not identify a comp to, but like, I like the way music also weaves together the story.
Yeah. Yep. That's all correct. It's like pushing 10 years ago now, I had this thought, someone should do 99% Invisible, This American Life style investigative reporting into someone's home game of RPG, right? And then like make that, is that actual play? I don't care, but like someone should make that. And I spent a long time asking around and thinking about my own experience, like what is the right story to tell to like do that with. And then in January of 2025, I played a session of Yuzeva's Bed and Breakfast for the first time. And I came home and I was like, I'm having this like weird, profound emotional experience coming out of this game that is like involves the game, but involves the sort of like extra textual experience that I had playing the game and the relationships with a certain other person at the table in particular that I had while playing the game. And like, I would not have gotten to that point without the game, but also that's larger than the game itself. I have all of these feelings. I just want to write all this down. So I just wrote it all down. And then I was like, oh, this is the thing I've been trying to do for 10 years. Like, this is it. Like, I figured it out. Like, you could do the I'm Roman Mars, I'm going in and interviewing people about their session, and I still want to do some more episodes like that because I think that's interesting too. But it's not that kind of episode of This American Life. It's the kind of episode where someone comes in and just reads a chapter of their memoir to you, right? And we like put This American Life music underneath it and all of that. The musical comp I learned after the fact, I've been using the same stock library as Heavyweight, which is a podcast that I really love, from Jonathan Goldstein. It is a podcast in which he goes and finds a person and that person has something from their past that they regret or like otherwise are stuck on, haven't been able to let go. And he helps them like come to terms with it, usually by tracking down a particular person from their past and facilitating a conversation between the two of them. I think this is one of the greatest podcasts that's ever been made. It's really fantastic. And I think it has a lot of shared DNA with After Image also, where that one is the sort of outside reporter coming in doing this thing. But like, there's a lot of narration in that. There's a lot of, there are little clips of interviews, but also Jonathan is like sitting down with people and just, or sitting down and just like reading narration that he's written. And his narration is full of voice and jokes and all this other stuff. And so the first two After Images, I think the one that really people point to when they think about it is about a campaign of City of Winter that I ran.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, like 18 months ago. And that one, I mean, it's all just me narrating, but it also, as we were playing the campaign, this game is about generational turnover and trying to pass along the traditions of your culture that you care about to the people who come after you. And a lot of time really can pass in this game. You know, I played in a four-person game, and I started as playing a child. And by the end of the campaign, I was the only character who had, or I was the only player who had not switched characters because their character had passed away of natural causes. And I was now playing a like 70-year-old woman. And so it's just like her story, you know? But as we were playing this game, my grandpa was getting sick and getting older, and I saw my dad dealing with all of that. And I'm looking up at that even as my character is sort of starting from younger than my position, not thinking about any of this, going up through my stage of life and then up to my dad's stage of life and then my grandpa's stage of life. And you know, probably only 5% of the runtime, 10% of the runtime is sort of me talking about my family stuff. But the buildup of the story then really tinges, like the fiction really colors my real life story, and my real life story really colors the fiction. And you can, I think, see the ways that everyone is doing this all the time. Like, while playing the game, I was pulling thoughts I was having in real life. And stuff that was happening in the game was then bleeding out into how I was seeing my dad and my grandpa as they were going through the end of my grandpa's life. And then it was like a week after I published the thing, finally, that my grandpa did pass away. And I don't know. It's just... That's the thing that I made. I don't know. I'm really proud of it. I think it's one of the better things I've ever made. The number of compliments I've received on it seems to have borne that out. And I think it's just capturing, it's pointing at, let's say, whether or not it's successful, whether or not you think it's successful, it's pointing at this thing that is so true about RPGs that I just described, of the way they influence real life and real life influences play at the table, that I just don't see people pointing at that often. Like, I think our community of designers especially really loves RPGs and loves engaging with them, loves being at the table and playing at them, and loves talking about design because we can't play them all the time. And we can talk about the design of them or talk about making actual play or listen to actual play while we're at work. And like, that's a, you know, how the world works. But I think that has left this gap of looking back at our play, our sessions, in the way that you would look back at another text, at a novel or a movie or a poem your friend wrote and sent you by DM or like whatever the thing is, and analyzing it and thinking about it and like and considering it, holding it in your hand, and just sort of reflecting on it. And I love that. I mean, that's another huge part of Dice Exploder at large. And about me, I love that self-reflection. And so, yeah, I'm really glad I was able to bundle all of that together into After Image.
Oh, Yeah, it's just one of my favorite pieces of game media, like, truly. And I could compliment you all day, but, like, it's just I just like it. It's interesting. There's a really particular thing about Afterimage that I, like, identified in talking about this with the students, where I'm like, how many kind of voices are there in this? You know what I mean? It's like, how many voices are in this? And it's not just one. I mean, I know it literally is just one, but, like, it's not just one. There is, like, there is Sam the player. There is the character that you played in City of Winter, who's Harmony. And then there is a little bit of, like, a third voice that is kind of an omniscient connector between the two that you could argue for a bit. And it's an interesting thing when it comes to, like, what I like about this is it really tickled my brain and, like, made me think about, like, what actual play can be if we get really creative with it. If we start thinking outside of the bounds of point mic at players and play, what can we do with actual play that goes beyond this? And I mean, I think there are, like, other people in the space that are asking those same questions, like the Twice Rolled Tales crew and Panic Table with How's My Driving recently, of just, like, actually, how can we push on the edges of what people are willing to consider actual play? And I don't know if you answered this in your previous answer, actually, so I'm going to ask it again. Is Afterimage actual play in your mind?
As I was getting to the end of my answer, I realized that I had not answered that question. And I think it is an interesting question. I want to start with, can I say the thing that Afterimage taught me about actual play?
Please.
That thing is, I mentioned this earlier, actually. It really emphasized to me how hard it is to tell these stories. Like, the thing that a question that prompted Afterimage was, why is Let Me Tell You About My Character a negative meme? You know? Like, why is Let Me Tell You About My Home Game something that everyone's sort of like, here we go again, about? And the reason is because it's usually boring. Like, it's like, if you weren't there, like, it's boring to kind of hear about. Or, you know, it's not as impactful as if you were there. And I think we all kind of agree on that. But I was really curious about why? Like, why is that true? Because it's true even when you have a really good storyteller a lot of the time, right? Like, it's true because in real life, you have, like, a regular-ass story, right? We've all got that guy who we know who will tell you a story and it was like, yeah, cool, man. But, like, that same story told by your, like, uncle whose whole thing is, like, holding court and telling stories might be, like, a barn burner, you know? It's like big fish kind of thing, right? So, like, it's possible to make uninteresting stories really interesting. And in role-playing games, we have all these amazing storytellers. So, like, why was this thing? I concluded, it's just really fucking hard. Like, it's really fucking hard to tell these stories because, as you were pointing this out in the thing you were just saying, there are all these layers to what's going on. Like, you have to establish Sam. You have to establish Harmony. You have to establish not just kind of, like, who am I and what am I like, but what's going on in my life. And you have to establish who's Harmony, what's going on in her life, who are all those people. And, like, in traditional actual play, you then also, like, I'm bad at names, right? And in an audio medium especially, like, I have to establish there's Sam, there's Elliot, there's Brian, there's Harmony, there's Akaw, there's Mao. Who was playing Harmony? Who was playing Akaw? Who was playing Mao? The relationships, not just between the characters, not just between the players, but between the characters and the players. What if we're playing a game where you rotate around who's playing what character? Like, it's the GM is, like, playing 100 characters. Holes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, it's hard. It's just really hard to do. And so I think I did a good job with it in Afterimage by sitting down and, like, writing it out. It's not, if we sat down and I was over coffee doing the Let Me Tell You About My Character thing, I think the campaign is interesting, I guess. But, like, the interesting part would be when I'm talking about how my dad is, like, dealing with his dad dying and I'm thinking about mortality again, you know? And, like, then why are we talking about my campaign? Like until we sit down and I, like, do the writing, until I'm really good at, like, establishing all that stuff, like, and until, like, I think a lot of people are also really, it's really mercurial in stories what's in actual play, in gaming stories, like, what's the thing this story is actually about? Like, when I'm telling you a story of going and visiting my grandpa in the hospital, like, it's clear what that story is, like, fundamentally about. And when I'm clear, or when I tell you this story about playing a game, is the story about me playing the game? Is the story about my character doing, again, we're back to that, like, layering makes this really hard thing. So I learned that from the process of making these things. That has brought me into a lot of my opinions clarifying, crystallizing around actual play of, like, this is why it's so hard to do beginnings. Like, this is why I was talking about this earlier on this episode, because it's so goddamn hard to set up all this stuff. Like, that's why you need an hour-long episode to introduce your Orbital Blues series, even though I want a 10-minute episode to introduce it. Like, how would I possibly, like, set up all that stuff in 10 minutes and retain it? So I'm thinking about all that. Is this actual play? Is After Image actual play? I don't care. Like, that's my answer, right? Like, this is one of those taxonomies where, like, I think taxonomies, the thing with taxonomies is always, like, none of them are true, some of them are useful, right? And I think actual play, it's useful to think about this as a distinct medium from audio dramas, even improvised audio dramas. I think it is useful to think of it as a medium that is in its own right. You get to build community around that. You get to build some identity around that and so forth. And also, like, I don't know, is the video version of this podcast a movie? No, but... No, do we want to argue that it is? Like, sure. What if we put it in a movie theater? Is it a movie now? Like, you can do all those kinds of thought experiments, and I just care so much more about, like, whether this podcast is interesting. Like, I just is it something?
Yeah,
I
did you like
to?
It?
Did yeah, you yeah. like it? Yeah. did we have something to say? This is also why Dice Exploder has such a philosophy of specific examples. Like, I want to, we have a rule in the Dice Exploder Discord that is like, hey, if you're not enjoying a conversation, like, you should come in and ask for a specific example from the other people. And it really, really helps keep things grounded, because suddenly you can't just come in and, like, make blanket statements that, like, are dismissing someone else's identity, like, accidentally. And I'm not talking about, like, misogyny or something here. I'm talking about, no, like, creator OSR identity, stuff,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can't just come in and be like, well, things always work this way, because someone else can show up and be like, what about this thing where it doesn't work like that? You know, it makes you think about the specific. And I'm so much more interested in thinking about the specific and what we can learn from the specific. Like, what is that Orbital Blues season of My First Dungeon doing that's effective that I can pull into After Image? Like, what is This American Life doing that's effective that I can pull into After Image or into actual play as a medium? I find that so much more productive than trying to answer the question, is this actual play? Where, like, everyone's going to have a different reason. A lot of those reasons are going to be good. A lot of the reasons for, but I think just anyone holding on tightly to a category is typically doing so because of identity reasons that end up feeling like clenched. It's like you're holding on tightly and constraining yourself in a way that just doesn't feel useful to me. And that's really separate from, do you like the thing? Is it good? Do you want to include it in your awards show for actual play? There are reasons to, like, you know, hold down lines there or whatever. I don't know. Like, but is it fundamentally in this arbitrary category, the language around which has been changing rapidly for the entire duration of its existence? Like, is anything that's not a written play report on a forum actual play? I say no. Fuck you guys. You know, like, that's what it sounds like to me. So
oh my God, my brain is moving a lot on this. Like, and there's a few different things that have, like, clicked with me about this. Things, the idea of someone, like, hearing about someone's character is not interesting. Sure. Hearing about someone's dream, people compare it to. It's like, oh, yeah. Let me tell you about my dream, and that's not interesting. And I think it's like, I I always get, I rub up against this idea a little bit because there's many people in my life where I'm like, yeah, I'd love to hear about your dream.
Totally.
And I think it's like, it's the connection to that person. And I think that like the work that you had to do in making After Image was establish the connection to the audience where they now care about Sam's dreams. They now care about Sam's play story. And I think that part of that comes from being a good storyteller. I think part of it, there's another connection in here that I'm feeling to like After Image as actual play is closest to when I've seen people do solo game actual play.
Yeah.
Where there is this weaving between character first person, player first person. Like Dylan does a lot of them on One Shot, Dylan Apelian. And I think what After Image taught me as a player and as an actual play creator is that like thinking about what my stories are about at the table is important and part of it. And that part of the work of actual play is kind of at its best doing what After Image did post game. In situ with game. Like that's like if we're doing our job right in actual play, we're getting people to feel that connection that you made in this sort of play report style podcast in the moment of play. And I think that's hard. And I don't know that we always nail it. And like,
well, because you don't have to just do all the things I was saying were hard before, but you also have to figure out what the thing is about in situ, right? Like with After Image, I didn't realize that City of Winter campaign was about my grandpa dying until I was like reasonably far into the campaign. And at a certain point, my grandpa's dying in the game and he's dying in real life. And I'm like, all right, I see what's going on here. But like, but that campaign also is like not just about that because like the other three people at the table, their grandpas weren't dying, you know? And so like, there's a lot from that campaign that I left out too because it was not – it didn't matter to the particular through-line story that I wanted to tell from that campaign, you know? And in an actual play, in a live actual play, in the kind of actual play that My First Dungeon is, you can't do that in the same way because you don't know where all those plot lines are going. Like you have to – have the whole stew. You can't just pick out the parts that then neatly form a narrative later, right?
Or you'd have to make a whole other thing.
It's part of the beauty of actual play too, is that like, well, where's this going? I mean, that's part of the beauty of like Lost, right? Like the TV show. genuinely, like where's that going? I don't know. We're along for the ride. It's just like a different kind of storytelling, I think.
Well, and this is another thread I want to pull on, and it's funny you bring up Lost because you're a screenwriter in addition to a game designer and podcaster. And I think that there's something in here I'm trying to find about the idea of like when you can tell – there's a thing that I always find to be my – feeling of high praise for a piece of like screen media of a film or a television show. And I will say this, and it maybe sounds like pretentious at times. I'm like, oh, that writer really trusts their audience. That writer really didn't think the audience was stupid and needed to be handheld through something. Like they trusted the audience and they let them experience and guide the story. And I'm coming to a conclusion that I don't know if I agree with, and I want to maybe circle around, is that do we not trust our audience enough in actual play? Are we, like, overly expository in actual play, or is that just the side effect of creating live at the table? Like, it might just be that. Like, we're over-expository to the audience because we have to be to the table to build the story together, but I wonder what a more trim trusting the audience actual play looks like. And maybe that's about the edit. Maybe that's kind of that's where that goes. But
yeah, that's what I would say. That's about the edit. Yeah. But also, I don't know. I think the struggles of marrying the medium of role-playing games, in which throat clearing is fun, with the medium of audio drama or what have you, where throat clearing is a waste of time a lot of the time, there's just a lot of friction there, you know? There's just a lot of friction there. And I think that's the primary thing going on. But I bet there's probably room to trust your audience more. There's always room to trust your audience more. It just narrows your audience.
GameFound is inviting you to participate in their second RPG party, a curated event designed to help indie TTRPG creators bring their projects to life through crowdfunding. Whether you're working on a zine, a 600-page collection of tomes, or something more esoteric, this is a unique opportunity to move forward with real support, visibility, and expert feedback. Applications will be reviewed by a panel of judges from GameFound and industry partners like Darrington Press, Modiphius Entertainment, Free League Publishing, and Magpie Games. 15 to 25 projects will be selected to receive workshops with industry experts, marketing support, one-on-one mentorship, and a community of fellow designers to grow together. Open call for submissions lasts from May 5th to 26th, and crowdfunding goes live this fall. Let this be the push you need to manifest your game in the physical realm. It's going to be challenging, there's going to be stress, and if you're able to put in the work, it's going to be so incredibly rewarding. Go to gamefound.com/blog for more information and to submit your project today.
This episode was brought to you by the World Builders Club, a project of Working Families Power, an organization building power for the multiracial working class. The World Builders Club is your go-to dispatch for breaking down the political, cultural, and emotional architecture behind your favorite universes. From romantasy novels and TTRPGs to blockbuster franchises and indie gems. This isn't just pop culture analysis. It's a love letter to the art of creating worlds and the power those worlds have to shape our own. I'm a huge fan of post-apocalyptic world building, so I recommend starting with their piece, We Can't Stop Watching the World End, which talks about properties like GLaDLands, Fallout, and Silo, and what they have to say about humanity and our ability to imagine a world after the apocalypse. But any piece on World Builders Club is going to be a great read for those of us who love to imagine better worlds. So join the club and build a better world with them by subscribing at bit.ly/WBC Many-Sided or by searching World Builders Club on Substack.
Hi, my name is Robin.
And my name is Dylan.
Do you like Choices Matter video games?
If so, we started this podcast, Dorkspawn, so that I could show my best friend my favorite RPG series of all time, Dragon Age.
And now that I've played it, we want to share more of these choice-heavy games with each other.
Right now, Robin is showing me Mass Effect, which I have never played before.
And we are going to continue playing through these games together and discussing them book club style as we go.
You can join our Discord and play along with us and tune into Dorkspawn every Friday wherever you listen to podcasts.
This kind of reminds me of, there is a bugbear that I've been having recently about actual play, a thing that I've recently realized I hate, and it's almost always bad. And it is the thing that kind of has to happen. It's like a thing of the format. And it is, first episode, we're introducing characters. Hey, Sam, tell me about your character. And then all of a sudden, it's like a 2 or 3 minute monologue describing how they look and like the scar on their eye and what their weapons are. And every time I hear it in actual play, and I've heard it, I've realized it because I hear it in My First Dungeon all the time. There's always so much like action getting up to that point of like, oh, there's this cool, Elliot's describing how the light looks as the thing comes around. And then we see a character. Who is that character? Brian, describe your character. Okay, so my guy's name is Barf, and he stands about 6 foot tall, and it's like the energy just goes fucking to the floor. And no matter how, like, often those descriptions are really cool and epic, and this character is cool, but it's just like, I'm thinking in the Wild Sea, if the ship is going down, all in like, oh, there's a character, who's your character? He's this guy, but that doesn't matter because the ship is at a 45 fucking degree angle. And then we have a whole fucking episode where I can tell you more about my character, because that's what also happens in every television show and movie. Like, there's not a 5 minute thing at the beginning where everyone's just like, hi, my name's Matthew Murdock, also known as Daredevil.
I mean, the thing is, this is classic screenwriting shit, is like, the thing that people care about is relationships. Right. The thing that people care about is it's relationships. I'll just say it again. And when we sit down and you're telling me that you got a scar on your eye and you got a cool sword and stuff, I'm like, but who are you? Like, what matters? It's when people are making like tough choices, and especially when people are making tough choices about the other people in their life. And so, yeah, like in a lot of ways, like the ship is going down. I actually don't give a shit about that because I don't know about the ship yet, right? What I care about is like once you put someone on that ship, I want to know, who do they prioritize? Do they prioritize themselves at the expense of their friends? Are they going to rescue their friends? Which of their friends are they going to rescue? Like, that's the thing that's exciting.
And I think it's just like, it's a thing. I want to see more of it. I really just want to get rid of that chunk of time in this at the beginning of every action play. It's like, let's introduce your character with a scene where I describe a lot of them. It's like, there's something about, it doesn't even have to be in medias res, like in the middle of action. It could just be in medias res in the middle of characters being around.
John Wick, his wife has died, you know? And like, that's the way we get to know him. Like, I actually don't care about him during the opening flashback when he's been shot and his car's crashed. That's just sort of like a shitty thing that should be cut from the movie, in my opinion. Like, actually, the thing that's exciting about him is like, oh, he's sad. He's a sad dad because his wife died.
He talks to a mysterious guy and then he gets a puppy. And
yeah, it's exactly. Like, well, and that's the thing. It's like, he's sad because his wife died. What is it? Dead dog wife is the like trope now. Like, he's got a tropey dead wife. Okay, I get the now or like really shorthanding thing, but whatever. But then like, oh, but he's talking to a mysterious guy. He's a guy with a dead wife and he has a mysterious past. Ooh, we have all these relationships going on. They're all interesting. Tell me more about this mysterious man. Like, that's, yeah, I want to lean in on that. I think, though, the problem, this is another thing where I think actual play is just early on, and like stuff about the RPG medium makes it hard to do good storytelling for an audience, because in role-playing games, typically the thing that you do is you sit down at the table and you have to do a lot of feeling around. Who's this guy? What's going on here? Like, you have to just try shit out. Like, I'm in this Under Hollow Hills campaign right now, right? And it took 4 or 5 sessions for one of the players to like figure out who their guy was, right? And now we all have a really good sense of that guy. And we had this incredible episode yesterday with that guy, like, you know, flirting with another character's ex and like, you know, being a villain and turning a child into a puppet and like all this kind of like weird stuff that was going on, right? But like, you just have to like play to figure that out. And like, that's really true in writing, right? Like, you know, you constantly in screenwriting have to go back and revise your character introductions over and over and over again to like set up where's the place they're going to end up. And like in actual play, you don't have that luxury, right? Like, you have to do some of that throat clearing in advance to understand where they're going. But there's still tools you can do, right? There's still tools you can use to like get that kind of set up. But I think it's really hard, and you can't play the whole campaign and then go back and play it again. Like, you are always going to be at a disadvantage to media where you can intentionally revise those introductions a little bit.
And just the fact that it's like audio, there is some limitations of audio only, of like visuals. If someone walks in and they have a specific kind of lighting, it's like, great, I kind of already know.
Which you get
I
the shorthands.
Music, there are shorthands, but
it's medium limited stuff. But yeah, I think to me the big limitation here is like when you're writing as you go, that is harder than when you're writing in advance. And like, maybe the thing that people should be doing more is more, let's play a couple of sessions of this game before we turn on the actual play part. You know,
that is a thing that we've talked about for my first dungeon, like doing a kind of session 0.5. Of like, let's just all play around and like we'll do an encounter, we'll do whatever, and just like try out your character voice, talk to each other. So then hopefully by the first session, like when I think of Izora from the Abby's character, Izora from the Wild Sea, I could not tell you what she looks like. I have absolutely no idea other than that she is a like, I think Gao? Ketra? I don't even remember. But I remember her having a bone maraca and being just like kind of a weird, creepy woman who just appears behind you. I'm like, that's your character. What she looks like, I have no idea. I would never have any memory. And I'm probably one of the people who's listened to it the most, but I really remember, and I immediately remember, she just appears behind you and says, how are you doing? Like, all of a sudden, that's the game of any scene that you're playing in, and that's the relationship that you can play with anytime you want to. I just want us to get to that quicker. We're
about to record a session one. At time of recording, we're about to record a session one of a new season. And I'm GMing. And like, I'm like, oh man, what can I do differently with this intro to avoid this? Like, trying to think of like the part of me, the thought I just had that I think is maybe insane is like, record the first scene where it's like, maybe it'll be action, I haven't decided yet, of like, and like when people's voices chime in, introduce your characters, do that whole thing, and then be like, all right, we're gonna do that one more time, we're gonna just zoom back 15 minutes and you're not gonna introduce your character this time, but now we all know what your character is like, and just let it inform how you act, and we'll get a description later.
That's, I was about to say, my suggestion is just don't do it, see what happens. Like, because that's what movies are doing, right? It's like, yeah, as Brian was saying, we don't have Keanu sit, go like, so I'm playing Mr. John Wick, and his thing is like, yeah. The tricky part is differentiating the characters and the players, like in an audio medium, especially when you don't have visual indicators. I think that there's a lot to be done in terms of just casting people with unique and different sounding voices to like help improve that. I'm curious what happens if you just skip it. This is also a huge problem with actual play, though, is just that, like, what we're talking about solutions here where, like, yeah, come on, let's do a whole session before we get started, right? It's just, like, a lot to ask of people, too, although I guess it's a lot to ask of people to show up on a film set, so what do I know?
I mean, we're doing 10 sessions for this game. I mean, it's gonna, and part of me, because of that, is, like, I actually don't think I need you to know what these characters are like off the bat. You're about to spend 10 sessions with them. I'm really considering the maybe cooking. Just don't. The maybe just don't. Maybe yeah. Just don't do it.
Just don't
maybe
do
just
it.
Like just call, address them by name and ask them like what they're doing the first time we hear from them, and then it's like you can share details later on if you're like in role play and you can be like, he shifts this thing or something like that. Sure. Like if you want to describe a particular like sword or something, like, but I am not going to ask you to describe your character. I might hold myself to that. I'm interested
you know
in doing
thing
that.
The thing I think of though is that, and now we're just talking about producing actual play, but like, I think it is such
talk
a staple.
The table. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's true. I do think that it's such a staple though, that if you say, hey, Brian, pretend I'm someone else, I guess, that I don't have this bugbear, but like, hey, Brian, what is your character doing? I think almost almost without exception, someone would say, I'm doing this. Brian stands at 6 foot.
Yeah. Yeah.
The UC. You would get the UC. And yeah, I don't know. I think it's the thing if we want to do it, we have to be really explicit about we are going to try to do this. And I actually think I kind of like your idea of like, let's do it, get it out of our systems, and then take it back and be like, we've already... Because I think that is a thing, if you do a good enough session zero, that some of that kind of gets solved. Like, you don't have to search for those answers because you've already found them. And that's kind of what, like, a session 0.5 or even just, like, doing that opening description and then doing it again. Because now it's like, great, we all know. We will interact with each other knowing those relationships of, like, I know that... Abby's character is like this, and now I can approach her like that. Whereas before, until she gives me the description, I can't fully interact with her because I don't have anything else to go on. I have no information.
I think there's also something here. Like, I really have loved in the bit of Brennan Lee Mulligan that I have watched, like GMing, something that he does at the start of every actual play is like, let's do a spotlight scene on each character. This is like the classic thing that's going on in like the first episode of all of his games. And those spotlight scenes often include we see the like description of the character. But in my mind, I do think we could skip past some of that stuff still, but it's much less grating because the first thing that we do is we set up the tough situation that character finds themselves in, right? And we get, like, I'm thinking about the beginning of The Wizard, the Witch, and the Wild One, where we start on the Wild One, like, in a barn being, like, hunted by Wild One hunters, you know? Like, by fairy hunters. And, like, we kind of know that setup, and that... again, immediately provides like a character relationship of like, who's this PC? Who are the people around him? Like, what, we can feel the tension in the air, and that tension then carries us through. So what does he look like? What's the deal here? What are we actually seeing? Because I'm willing to sit with that when I like have a reason to, you know, like then it's anticipation. Then we are like better frosting the cake of like, what is the juicy action going to be? Whereas when you just show up right away and it's like, so you walk into the tavern, who are you, Brian? It's like, none of that tension's in the air. Now I'm just like sitting here listening to crap.
It does just dial down for me the thing that you said, that like everything in screenwriting is relationships. And like, we've said that even larger of like, I don't think people watch actual play for story. I think people follow people. Like, you are excited by the story, but you're following the performers or you're following the characters, maybe. Those are the things you actually will come back for. And it is just like, yeah, setting up those relationships and understanding that the stuff that doesn't matter can fall away, even though it is comforting and is a normal part of the medium. Just every time I edit it or every time I hear it, it just kills the energy, and it's always cool and interesting and fun, and I hate it.
Man, well, okay, I've taken us all the way down After Image Lane in this conversation about Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Thank you for walking down it with me.
I love it.
It's I don't know if I even have fully reckoned with what I think it's impact should be maybe on actual play creation, but I'm getting there. I want to make something in as like a response to how that made me feel. And I don't know what that thing is yet, but that's kind of like where it's living in my brain right now.
Yeah. Well, actually going back to After Image, you know, I've got a few other episodes. I did this like most recent episode where I have some more interviews, and I have a couple other ideas for stuff I want to do and like play with the format a little bit. And one of those is kind of about pre-gen stuff where, yeah, I've described the setup for Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, right, where we have my favorite friend, Barf, and I explained calling cards earlier. So Barf's typical calling, all the pre-generated characters come with two calling cards, and then you as the player bring a third. So you get to make one up and put your fingerprints on the character. I really like this as a way of like building some investment in the characters while also using pre-generated characters and a lot of the benefits that come from that, right? So Barf typically has the stench of cigars and bloody knuckles. And then he's got a third thing that's whatever. And he also has pronouns, you know, he, him. He's got a name. His name's fucking Barf. He's got artwork, which is this very disgusting picture of a gross-looking man with a Hawaiian shirt. And you know, you look at all, oh, and he's got a need. He needs a new kidney. Okay, great. Like that's Barf, our guy. And then you get to add an ingredient to this, right? So you get to add homemade Pepto-Bismol, or you get to add a stuffed teddy bear, or you get to add a good heart, you know, like, or you get to add, hold on. You get to add a toothy grin, something else like creepy to make him even more unsettling. Make him feel scary and not just kind of like, ugh. And that's like a bunch of different versions of Barf. Here's a trick. Here's a fun thing that's included in the book. What happens when you give him a cybernetic arm and you make the whole game cyberpunk now? Like you completely change the setting by giving this one character one thing. Or give him a giant cartoon mallet, and now we're doing like Toontown noir, right?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different ways you can take this stuff. I want to do an After Image working title, 10 Guys Named Barf, where I just interview 10 different people about their 10 different Barfs, right? Like, who was he in your game? And like, what happened? Who was he in your game? And like, what happened there? Did he die? Did he get his revenge? Was he like a random supporting character who like disappeared briefly? Do you not remember him at all? Who did you hope he would be? And then he didn't end up being that person. I think that there's something there that, first of all, like will demonstrate, I think, one of the beautiful things about Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, this ability, this thing that goes back to like Apocalypse World, where they have, you know, this list of names that everyone's pulling from for NPCs. And so every game kind of has a a Dremmer, right? And what's your Dremmer like? Like, who is he in your situation? And you get to, or like in Blades in the Dark, every game has every Duskfall has a Skurlock. But what's the Skurlock up to in your game? So you get that kind of sense, but you also, I'm hoping that it will kind of dive into that, like, that feeling of even when you have a pre-generated character, there is room to bring your version of Hamlet to the role, right? There's who was your Lady Blackbird? Who was your Barf? Like, who, what was the thing that you saw in this part, this pre-generated character, this person who was dormant? They were a puppet lying limply on the table until you came along and stuck your hand in there and started playing around with them again. I think that that's just what I find beautiful about pre-generated characters. And I'm excited to try to do that with Bandits and Bullet Holes.
That's very fun. And I think there's like a fun thing where it's like, obviously City of Winter is very heavy, but that version with Bandits and Bullet Holes, you get to ask the same question of people. And I think will be an interesting answer of like, what was going on in your life that made Barf this way? Or in like the other people at the table's life that made Barf this way, and like how you found your own version of the character through play. So that you kind of preempted the question where I was going to transition and say, how did After Image inform your design of Band-Aid and Bullet Holes, if it did?
So I think the actual play conversation is really interesting, because I think a lot of stuff that makes, not this isn't universal, but a lot of stuff that makes for like better, tighter actual play also makes for better, tighter play. And I really like that. I really like tight as a drum kind of stuff. And I think Band-Aids and Bullet Holes has really gotten there. And so a lot of the kind of stuff that we've been talking about of what's the setup here and why do I care? I mean, I described this earlier with the way Band-Aids and Bullet Holes works, right? You start, the first choice that you make in the game is what powder keg are we going to play with? What's the scenario? Like, did I leave you dead by the side of the road after a heist and now you've survived and you're coming back to get me? Or are we doing that rival, one of our mentors was murdered and we're rivals about that kind of thing? Like, you pick that situation, and that situation has inherent tension built into it in the first place. And then we cast it, right? And so then we're doing the, like, how do you tell me about your character kind of thing. But as we're doing so, we're doing it in the context of already knowing what that central conflict is going to be. And so we can make sure we can cast the right person for that conflict. I think that that's not something that I learned from actual, or not something that I learned from actual play or from After Image. I think that is the same root instinct coming out in my taste about actual play and how I made After Image, and then coming out in my design here also. But, you know, every time I'm right about it, I believe it's stronger. So I'm sure there was some like influence there also. But I think that that's a big thing. The other thing, you know, this is like classic what I've learned from doing Dice Exploder, what I've learned from doing game design, what I've learned from doing an artist, is like, it's really helpful to step back and ask, so what's your game about? What's your thing about? What's going on here? And in a long way, certainly like After Image is just me doing that for 45 minutes. Like it's me looking at this campaign I'd already played and going, what are we doing here again? But I found in my writing process and really in my design process and in Band-Aids and Bullet Holes specifically, it's really useful every couple of months to just go like, okay, throw out everything. Why was I doing this again? What's going on here? What is the thing that I liked about this? Am I still doing that? Like, how can I refocus around that? And Band-Aids and Bullet Holes, I think I wanted it to be a game that was about that, like, what is the cost of revenge? But the more I played it, I do think it is sort of interested in that question, but it also just kind of like poppy and fun. Like, I think first and foremost, it is a game that is like, let's be sick as hell. Like it's more like pop commercial entertainment than it is like, let's wrestle with a deep question, you know? And I think that makes it really different from After Image. Like After Image just is something, After Image is taking the product of a system that was created with some intentionality, and then analyzing the product as much as the system. And when I'm just making the system, I'm just kind of, I think I'm less focused on that result. Like, making a game is asking a question, and After Image is answering someone else's question for myself. I guess there may have been more things in there that that related between the two, but I think of them as pretty different sides of my work.
We've talked a lot about like the theory and the design element behind Bandits and Bullet Holes, but I also want to get into, I noticed this is the first physical product you're putting out, and where most people would start with a zine or a trifold or a, you know, Mixum book, you're going full box set, which is a whole other production nightmare, as Elliot, as you've heard on this podcast from a number of people, including my co-host Elliot. What made you feel confident to go from 0 to 1,000?
First of all, I didn't. I put out like a little design memoir called Dice Forager about 18 months ago, I didn't do a crowdfunding campaign for, but it was, I printed like 100 books. I did pre-orders. I talked about it on Dice Exploder, the podcast, and I talked about it on the Discord. And I was like, my goal for this project is not to make a lot of money. It's not to do anything else. I just want to learn how to print a book. And so I did. I learned how to print a book. It was a lot easier than I thought it was. And I feel very comfortable with that now, right? So that's, I think, why I feel comfortable going up to box set here, is because, you know, maybe I should have gone up to crowdfunding campaign, but I'd also done crowdfunding campaigns separately. I'd crowdfunded seasons of Dice Exploder before. So I'm doing more for that this time, but I'd done Baby's First crowdfunding campaign, Baby's First Get a Book Printed. Now the new thing this time is like extra marketing and box set, and doing two things was a mistake. Maybe I should have just picked one of those, but here we are. And then I also, my friend Lady Tabletop, who I think is an excellent designer and sort of personality in the scene, they work for Exalted Funeral too, doing logistics stuff over there. They're very much helping me with a lot of the box set kind of stuff. And that's been a huge load off and help over there. So all those things are what made me feel comfortable getting to box set on this go around. And really, I mean, listen, the reason I'm here talking to you today, the reason I'm doing any of this crap is I just want to hold that box set in my hands. Like, I don't want the book. I don't give a fuck about that book. You don't back at the book tier. Just, yeah, it's not worth your time.
Don't back the book tier. Don't the book tier.
Crazy.
I just want, like, the thing that I want is the box set. Like, I've play tested this game a lot. Like, I'm a big, big believer in, like, I don't think every game cares about getting played, frankly. And if your game doesn't care about getting played, what do we need to play test We Are But Worms, a one-word RPG? I do not think that we do. Do we need to play test Honey Heist? I do not think that we need to do, even if it's then fun to play, you know. But like, for this kind of game, I wanted to make tight as a drum mechanics. Like, I hope it looks good. I hope you like it. Hope you like hearing me talk about it, because boy, have I been talking about it a lot in a lot of different places. But like, what I want is your experience at the table. I want like my cousin's experience at the table, my cousin's friend who has no idea who I am. I want him to be able to open the box. I want them to be able to open the box, pull out the game, and be like, oh, this rips 2 hours later. Like, that's what I am designing for. And like, this game wanted to be a box set. That's why I'm doing a box set.
It's very much going back to the thing you're saying, like, listen to what the game wants to be. And this is a game that wants to be a box set.
It's a game that wants to be a box set.
Well, I commend you on the large leap that you're making. I think it's great.
Thank you. The other thing that I'll lay out there is I struggled a lot with a particular part of this. I realized eventually that this game wanted to be entirely on cards, right? And not like, because for a while there was a version where you had like a deck of playing cards and everyone had their calling cards, all their characters had calling cards, but we didn't have, we also had character sheets. And I eventually figured out we don't want that. We want this kind of like shared relationship map, this powder keg in the middle of the table, but that's like one, it's like the Blades in the Dark crew sheet for the table effectively, right? It's like what's going on in the network of characters. So I knew the game wanted to live entirely on cards. So at that point I had kind of like two options for how to do calling cards. The first was I could write entirely custom calling cards, right? So the game, like, Barf always has his stench of cigars. He's always got his bloody knuckles. And then here's a stack of 52 additional playing or like calling cards, pick one, and now that's part of Barf. And that's fine. That'd be fun. I play tested that. That worked well. It would have been fine. I would have had to print 52 extra custom cards, and I would have lost the playing card aesthetic that I really liked, but that's a version of this game that would be good. Maybe it'll get printed in the future. The other option that someone suggested to me was keep the regular deck of playing cards, Sharpie the card right on there. Like, the reason I'd had character sheets before was so that you could write, okay, Barf's got his stench of cigarettes, and we write Ace of Spades next to that. And then when I flip up the Ace of Spades, I check his sheet, and I know that's what's going on. And this person was like, no. I don't want to do all that bookkeeping. I don't want to do any of that. I don't want the character sheet. I just want to write homemade Pepto-Bismol right there on the Ace of Spades. And then I want to flip that up and go, ha-ha, my Pepto-Bismol is good once again. And people really don't like that. People like when you sit down at the table and you run this game for people, they're like, I love Sharpieing on this deck of cards. And then they're done and they're like, that game was great. Am I going to have to chew up a deck of cards every time I play this game? They really get uncomfortable about that. And I think that's fair. And also, I decided to lean into like, I want to do that for the sickos, you know, like I want this game to be the game where like, if you love writing on a deck of cards, here's another game for you. And like, you know, I did some other stuff to help mitigate that. The game's going to come with a deck of cards so that people don't feel like they have to go to Target every time they want to play. They can at least have a place to start. But that's also something I was thinking a lot about and struggled with for a long time in the design.
Yeah, I think it's the right move. I think more things that create souvenirs of play and are like Wreck Your Deck style, it's just those are the things you can, like, I used to work as a magician, and I have had people come up to me years and years and years after I did a trick for them, and they signed their name on a card, and they pull it out of their wallet.
Yeah.
And it's like, people will, if they have, you know, homemade Pepto-Bismol that someone came up with one night, someone will take that and frame it and put it on a wall. And that becomes like a part of their life now in a way that a pre-written card simply wouldn't. Not that it's bad, it's just different.
Well, and I did this trick where I eventually figured out, if I take these people who were like, oh no, we ruined a deck of cards after the game, and I tell them, no, you keep that deck of cards and you bust it out next time, and now it's a legacy deck, right? Like, now this is your city, your mythology, your like mythos of Band-Aids and Bullet Holes and John Wick. People were like, oh, like, yes, I can do that. Like,
I love the legacy aspect of that. That when I was reading through the preview doc, I was like, that is super, because the whole thing of John Wick is kind of like the continental and this whole like weird world of what John Wick is. Like, when people think of John Wick, it is kind of the guy, but it's also like the world of it. And the second that like homemade Pepto-Bismol becomes a card that a bunch of people could take, like, now you have this idea of like this weird item of power getting passed around to people. It's I could see that being really popular.
It becomes a recurring motif in your box set, right? As you play, right? Like, once you have, because you're also giving calling cards to locations. So like, once you have Rolling Fog as a calling card in your deck of 52, then first of all, sometimes a character gets it, and anytime they show up, the fog rolls in, and that fucking rips, awesome. Right? And so, but also, it's like your city's just really foggy. Like, it's just constantly that fog's coming back, you know? Or if, like, the thunder and rain, it's just storming all the time in your noir city, right? Or, you know, that kind of recurring visual motif. Anytime you can reincorporate something from before, I feel like that is, it just feels, that rhyming is something that people love and starts to like push people in a particular direction. It inspires them to draw connections between what they're doing and what they did before, even if it's not this particular connection. And I think doing that across playthroughs of the game is a really, really exciting thing to do.
It also creates stories between the stories that you told of like, if in one story, Barf had like, you know, Radiant Sunshine, and then in the next story, he has Rolling Fog. Well, like,
what happened to Barf between the stories where one time he's in sunlight and the next time he's, you know, Batman coming out of the fog?
Yeah. Or when Queenie picks up that homemade Pepto-Bismol, is it like she and Barf moved in and she's got a line on his Pepto now? Or like, did she kill him and take his family recipe or whatever? Right. Yeah.
And then exactly. That informs like what the backstory is. Yeah, I'm really excited about that legacy aspect. That it's such a clear little thing that has so much potential to it that I really love. We have been at this interview longer than almost any other interview outside of our roundtable.
You're welcome.
We might be at a record.
We might be at a record. So we should begin to move to an outro, though I know none of us want to. Sam, why don't you tell us a little bit about just the specifics behind the crowdfunding campaign for Band-Aids and Bullet Holes. Let people know when it's running, where they can get it, and what they can get if they back this project.
Band-Aids and Bullet Holes is on Kickstarter on May 4th. That's probably in the past. It runs through May 29th, which is probably in the future. You can go on Kickstarter. You can Google Band-Aids and Bullet Holes Kickstarter and get there. There's probably a link in the show notes. That's where you can go. That's where you should go. Once you are there, you can get the game in three different forms primarily. Those forms are as a digital PDF with all the play materials you'll need to, you know, these powder kegs that I've been talking about, these character cards that I've been talking about, all that stuff you can just like print out at home and assemble yourself. I love doing that. Not everyone loves doing that though. Some people want something more substantial. So you can also get the book, right? You can get the book. It'll come with all the PDFs. You can print out stuff at home, just like you print out character sheets for any kind of game. But you also get the physical book to have as a reference at the table, if you like that, and to just read through. I really wrote this thing to be read and the reference sheets to be used at the table. So I think it'll be a good read and it'll be a nice little book on your shelf. Or you can do the thing that I think you should really do. You can go and you can get the box set. And the box set is really what I'm talking about here. We will have printed out all this stuff for you. The powder kegs will come on like game boards that you put in the middle of the table. The custom character cards will be in there with like nice art that's printed well and with brighter colors than your home printer will be able to manage. And you won't have to go buy some sleeves from the game store to like put together your little custom deck. It's all right there. It'll all be in the box. The book will be there in the box too. And the box will look nice. I'm getting, as of recording, I haven't gotten a lot of the layout done, but Dungeon Club is going to do it. And Dungeon Club stuff is just phenomenal.
Oh,
if you want to see what the game is going to look like, just Google DNGN Club, and you'll see some hot shit. So that's the baseline of the game. The game is also going to come, that book is going to come in the back with a lot of additional calling cards, right? So the game, it has like a random table of like 52 additional calling cards to get your brain going on, like, you know, give Barf a nail gun, or give him a toothy grin, or give him bisexual lighting. Great. We got a whole list of like cool stuff that'll feel very John Wick-y. But I've got a bunch of collaborators coming in who are putting together their own lists of like genre bending calling cards to go in there, right? So I've got Michael Elliott, who's doing a cyberpunk thing. And I believe Mikey Ham of Slug Blaster is going to be doing like a rural thing, like if you want to do Fargo instead, right? I've got John Harper is going to be doing a bunch of vehicles if you want to do like Fast and the Furious kind of vibes, like on top of your John Wick, really get those car chases going, that kind of stuff. Caro Assertion is doing the Toontown thing I was alluding to earlier. So I've got a lot of that kind of like extra kind of flavor packed into the back of the book for you too. That's what the Kickstarter is looking like.
Hell yeah. We'll put all those links in the show notes below. Definitely go check it out. And listen, do yourself a favor. Buy the box set. We've been talking about the box.
It's only like $50. You'll be fine.
Sam's rarely asking you for the box.
Yeah. If you, I will say, if you're a big fan of Dice Exploder, if you've been listening for a long time, this is the best way to support the show. If you want me to keep making Dice Exploder, get me excited to have made a game based on everything that I learned from doing the show.
And hey, you know what? If you can, buy two. Give someone a friend. You know,
why not?
Just do it. Why not? Fuck it.
it's hard out there. There's also, I think I'm also going to have a tier in there that's like the digital edition at a reduced price if you are experiencing financial hardship. Speaking of Michael Elliott, I know that he has done that for most of his Kickstarters. And I always really love to see that. So I really like, we're joking about like, yeah, buy three, buy four, why not? Give me all your money. I don't care. I just want people to play the game. I just want people to play the game. I think the best way to do that is by getting the box set, but also like there's a way to do that for a lot less money than the box set if you've got the time and inclination at home, and I want to make sure that that's accessible to you too. So there is going to be, oh, and we've also got a playingcards.io template coming out from Caro that is really shaping up to look good. It's not in its final form yet, but the digital edition will come with that. You'll be able to play online. The whole thing looks like a poker table, like as you're sitting down to like flip over your cards and stuff. And I think that's going to be a cheap way to play this game too, and is really going to light things up. So I just want you to play the game. Who cares about giving me money?
See, this is how podcasters go bust when they keep saying, hey, just do the thing, but don't worry about giving me money. Worry a little bit about giving Sam money. Worry a little bit. Well, Sam, thank you so much for coming on the show. Do you want to remind people where they can find you and all your stuff online if they're looking for you?
Yeah, I'm at diceexploder.com on Blue Sky, and then diceexploder.com is the best place to find all my stuff, or just Google Dice Exploder. You'll find all this stuff. The Dice Exploder podcast, the archives are fun. Go exploring.
And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk at the Table, you can become a member of the Many Sided Media Patreon to get access to ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, additional bonus actual plays from our podcast, My First Dungeon, a whole bunch of stuff. I think we have like, I don't know, 80 or 90 bonus hours of stuff that you cannot hear anywhere else. So go support us for 1 month and then cancel. You can download everything. You'll get a ton of stuff. As always, rate, review, and follow Talk at the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
We did it.
Whew. We did it.
Woo!
I think we did
Marathon
it twice.
Marathon Talk at the Table. I think we did it twice.